Theater Council, presenting David Sedaris, author, humorist, and frequent contributor to NPR and This American Life, live at the Virginia Theater on Monday, April 18th at 8 p.m. Ticket information at 356-9063.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening in this morning. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with an anthropologist who is well known as a scholar of social movements in Latin America. She has written on the competing forces of globalization and the cultural traditions of indigenous Mayas who live in Mexico and Guatemala, looking at issues of identity and cultural traditions, women's rights, popular movements, and so forth. After 50 years of study of indigenous communities in Mexico and Guatemala, she's considered to be a leading authority on Mayan activists and also leaders in Chiapas in southern Mexico, one of the poorest and most indigenous states in Mexico. She'll be talking about this subject, some of her work, in a talk this evening, and it's part of the MillerCom series. And that takes place tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Center on Illinois Street in Urbana. And all of these programs, they're always free and open to the public, so anybody who is interested in hearing the talk should feel welcome to attend. And we're fortunate to have her here with us. We have many people from this series on the program to bring them to a little larger audience, people who could not attend the talk. So we are here open to your questions and comments this morning. Our telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, which may not make it any easier, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And perhaps I should mention, I guess I did not, that June Nash is Distinguished Professor Emerita of Anthropology at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
I appreciate it. Just as a way of starting out, I think if we started to engage people in a conversation about the Maya and ask them what they knew, they'd say, probably say something like, well, this was an ancient people of Central America, and you can go today and walk around the ruins of their civilization, but the Mayans are long gone. Well, in fact, no, the Mayans are not long gone. There are millions of them still around today, particularly in Guatemala and in southern Mexico. So perhaps we could talk a little bit about the present-day Maya.
There are in Chiapas alone at least a third and maybe higher of the population. I say higher because some have chosen the path of acculturation, but they are still Mayas. They never call themselves Mayas, though. It's a term that was applied by archaeologists and derived from the early encounters with the Spaniards of people in the Yucatan. They call themselves the true people, Batsilwiniti. Yes. And my own career began with studying Mayas in 1954 in Guatemala. I was a student and not responsible, let's say, for the entire project by any means, but I learned at least to appreciate that depth of culture that you mentioned, David.
Mm-hmm. Yes. How do they live today? In what sense are they a traditional people, and in what sense are they a modern people? And maybe that's something of a mix of both.
Yes, there is. And today you see the changes in the last two decades are what have separated themselves from the kind of mud hut, thatched roof, no water, no electricity. When I first went there in the late 50s and early 60s in Chiapas, the Pan American Highway didn't even go down to Guatemala then. It was a muddy streak and sort of petered out. It was hard to know what was the road and what was an irrigation ditch in those days, and often one fell into it in the jeep, you know, by the hazards of driving. But in the 20 years, especially beginning the mid-60s and proceeding up to the present, they have become part of a world of consumption and in some cases released from subsistence cultivation to become comerciantes and undertake other careers. But most of them are losing their foothold in their own lands. This is one of the problems that they face and that I think some people are trying to address, the NGOs particularly.
Well, what sort of forces have they had to deal with, have come to bear on them? And it's been both, we talk about globalization, and it's something that seems sort of inescapable, forces that come from outside, but then the internal economics and politics, warfare, there have been all sorts of, they have really struggled from facing kind of pressures from all kinds of directions, both internal and external. What are some of those things?
When I first went in 1958, there was the beginning of what we used to call in those days a witch hunt, and it was the first experience of increasing pressure from the outside world. Often became an attack on each other because the internalization of so much of their life prior to that in the 500 years of resistance, as they call it, often meant a withdrawal into communities where they tried to find autonomy as a people. That very same withdrawal tactic became dangerous when the pressures mounted to draw them into the larger world. And they responded by attacking members of their own community, called witches at that time, brujos or ilolatik, and directing the hostility that came from those outside pressures, the increasing pressure for them to migrate, for example, down to the plantations, the pressures from indebtedness, which came from the Green Revolution, as it was called then, use of chemical additives to the cultivation process that often indebted them and caused a great deal of concern when they couldn't pay off those debts. I lived in a town where women were extremely important in the economy. In even pre-conquest conquest times, they were making pottery and selling it in a wide region. So their income became increasingly important. And this aggravated gender antagonism in the household. It didn't solve it as some of us had hoped. Rather, it often turned husband against wives.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly there are places around the world where we've seen very, very deliberate attempts by governments to forcefully, if not forcibly, get indigenous people to integrate into what would be a more dominant culture, perhaps a European one or a more European one. Has that happened with Maya? Has that happened in Mexico and in Guatemala, other places where they live? The definite, really a deliberate kind of government program of assimilation?
Definitely. And part of this was to draw the indigenous peasants out of a subsistence culture into that cash economy. And they did this often when Pemex, the national oil company in Mexico, started a petrochemical business. They wanted to sell the fertilizers and the pesticides, and the indebtedness drew them in. It's true that they increased output. There's no question about that. But there again, they notice after a 10-year cycle the depletion of the soils, and this aggravated some of the problems that they had faced as subsistence farmers and had less of a population to deal with. So the indebtedness and the dependence on government handouts created a dependency that they had partially avoided in the past, by going outside of their own economies to get the cash they needed, and that was to the plantations. Those plantations disappeared. The coastal coffee growers were no longer operating in the 1980s. So in that 20-year period, they either turned to northern migration or to footloose laborers in other people's fields.
Mm-hmm. How, in what ways have they been caught up with in internal political conflicts in the places where they live?
Tremendously important question, because the conflicts that started with definitions in terms of religion, as Protestantism entered and competed with Catholicism, as traditional Catholics who had had more or less independence without overseeing from the Catholic Church during a long period when they didn't have the funds to send priests out, then the religious conflict became a means of channeling and expressing some of those conflicts. As a result of the diminishing of the land resources, some of the indigenous pueblos began to expel on the basis of their religious differences. And there were 30,000 from one village alone that is right next to San Cristobal, the center, the colonial center for trade and the nexus for indigenous exchanges. 30,000 came into town in over a 10-year period. That religious conflict was often exacerbated by partisanship in the political parties. There once was a single party, as you know, for 70 years in Mexico, mm-hmm. the PRI, Partido Revolucionario Institucional, had dominated politics, but there were other parties that would get congresspeople in, and they began to move into center stage as they began to lose their hegemonic grip on the indigenous populations. These parties, especially the PRI, had a strategy of cultivating antagonism internally so that they wouldn't have to press the button themselves, and it would always be done through an alcalde, that's the mayor of the town, or another indirect agency, an indigenous agency always preferred, to move Indians against each other. That reached a climax in the latter years of the PRI, especially after the uprising of the Zapatista rebellious force. And in 1997, there was a massacre of people in Chenalo carried out by indigenous leaders of the opposite party against the group that claimed a new liberation theology, Catholicism, as their guiding light.
We have a caller, and I'd like to bring them into the conversation. Perhaps also I should introduce again our guest, June Nash. She is Distinguished Professor Emerita of Anthropology at the City University of New York Graduate Center. She's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk, talking about some of the work that she has done, writing about the impact of globalization and also military repression on the indigenous peoples of Latin America, specifically Mexico and Guatemala. She'll be giving a talk this evening at 7:30 at the Levis Center. It's a MillerCom event, so if you're interested and you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you should feel welcome. On this program, questions are also welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Caller here is on a cell phone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. My daughter just returned from Peace Corps service in the south of Belize, where there are a lot of Maya. And although that society purports to be egalitarian as far as the different cultures, I think that the Maya there are at the bottom, but that they're better off than the Maya in Guatemala, and there seems to be a lot of drift across the border because the border there is in the mountains. So I wonder if you would speak to that, to the Belizean situation.
The Belize situation has always been an escape jet. This was true even before the conquest. You know, there were Mayas moving up into Belize to get away from central power. So it has been a safety valve for the country as a whole. It was especially important during the years of terror and violence, and Mayo's escape not only there but into Chiapas and the Yucatan. The problem will always be there as far as the need until the need to find escape jets until the Mayas themselves attain what they want, and that is a relative degree of autonomy within the states they live in. They don't want freedom. The uprising of the Zapatistas was directed towards that. The peace process is again an attempt to retrieve their cultural base. However, they need the power to put into action their program of development, which differs considerably with what both governments, the Mexican government and the Guatemalan government, are proposing in terms of the ALCA, or the Area Liberal de Comercio for Central America. If that goes through, and it is already starting, then they won't have the kind of subsistence base that allowed them some degree of autonomy, even in colonial times and in the independence period. But I imagine you're pretty worried about your daughter. I met three young Peace Corps people in Cantel in Guatemala when I was there last month. They're doing a great job. They're working with indigenous people and with mestizos in that town to achieve some of the objectives defined by Mayas. And it's an important effort that they're making, I know, there.
Hmm. Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about, for the people, for the Mayas, as they think about development and as they think about how they would like their communities to be organized and how they would like to live. And you compare that with the ideas of the governments and along the same lines. How are they different? And how is it that what the Maya, what these people, the indigenous people want, is different from what the government seems to want?
When the Maya talk about autonomy, we often get the idea that they don't want it, a kind of an anarchic liberty. This is not at all their idea. They, within their own caracoles, which are these governing bodies that operate throughout the Lacandon in a semi-autonomous way, they are responding to people, and their adage of command while obeying applies to leaders as well as the base communities, that the leaders truly are trying to listen to what members of the community say. Now, as far as their active practicing autonomy goes, it's extremely limited because they don't have a budget. They don't have the assistance. They don't even have the basic services that other Mexicans have. And the same is true in Guatemala. Programs are set up, but they aren't funded, and we've seen that experience and heard about it from Victor Montejo, who was here as one of the speakers in the dialogue we've just had. So the autonomy movement is not to get rid of governing bodies. It is not anarchism. It is a responsible governing with participants entering into consensual decisions. It affects internal domestic affairs as well as external with other pueblos and with other governing bodies at a higher level in the nation. And the their ability to listen is a remarkable feature of a governing group that is seeking liberation. They're not dictating in any sense a single program of development. They're opposing the government program called the Plan Puebla Panama, which at one level speaks of participatory democracy but doesn't provide the mechanisms for realizing that in any kind of exchange between those who govern and those who remain as a local body without governing power or without the budget to implement it.
We have another caller. This is someone also in Champaign, line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to know if the Mayans are bilingual and if they have kept their own religion.
I think the Mayas proved to us that you can be yourself while communicating in the national language, because most of them now speak Spanish, which is the lingua franca of both Guatemala and Mexico. They also have retained a spiritual identification that in their idea is not competitive with either the Catholic or Protestant religions that they profess. To go into this language problem, the Maya proved to us, I think, that multilingualism is an asset and provides a rich cultural base for sharing with people of a different language group. There are, in Guatemala, the last time I heard, I think it was 18, and some say 21 languages. There are, of course, many cognates, and they can communicate with each other, but they go beyond just sharing a common vocabulary, the core of that vocabulary, but reaching out to seek communication with people of different languages within their own group. The same is true in Chiapas and in the country as a whole. There are many different languages. There are five different dialects of the Maya language in the state of Chiapas alone, and they are able to communicate, have had extensive commercial exchanges throughout their history. So the question I think you also raised, religious differences. And I'd like to refer here to Bishop Samuel Ruiz, who went to Chiapas in 1960 and served until 1998 when he retired. And in that period, he learned to listen to them. This is very unusual. People who go to Chiapas somehow learn from the Mayas how to listen. We are not good listeners in the United States, I think. It's one reason we have trouble learning other languages, as I did when I went down there and began my studies in Tzeltal. But the power that the bishop had to listen enabled him to hear truths that he shared in common as a Catholic with those who had spiritual identifications with nature, and professed in his own narration of those 30 years or more than that in office that they often had superior notions of how to identify spiritually with nature, how that might help the environment if we were to take on some of their understandings.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go again to someone else. This is someone listening this morning in Urbana, and it's line number two. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I wanted to ask Professor Nash if she could explain a little bit more why the Maya are under so much military pressure in Chiapas and in Guatemala. And could she explain what the Plan Puebla Panama is?
Two big questions. I'll try to answer them. In Mexico was not a militarized state until really the 80s. And even in the state of Chiapas, which was considered a kind of outlaw state, the military were a low-profile entity until 1986. I began to see the big barracks, Rancho Nuevo, 12 kilometers outside of San Cristobal, was being built up with a lot of fancy houses for the officers. It was going to be a whole regiment. And they were preparing for something, I felt. It wasn't clear what until I went there to stay for several summers beginning in 1989. And I and my students saw a gathering of forces both against the government and pressure against the indigenous pueblos that looked like it might reach a confrontation stage. The cane growers down in hot country who were, like many of the highland villages, bilingual, but with a strong tilt to their own linguistic group, and had formed their own campesino, an independent campesino group from that of the Confederation of Campesinos, really ordered by the president. There was a break in the kind of hegemonic control of the party, and three people were killed when they led a group of several hundred cane growers to the administration of the sugar refinery, asking for higher rates for their sugar. That was the first time I had heard of actual shooting by the army. And there was that overkill capacity that had built up in Rancho Nuevo. Mm-hmm. That became more and more evident as a pressure, that is, I'm saying the military became more and more of a pressure and control over an increasing protest group from among indigenous people. Simultaneously, there was the Organization of Indigenous People for the 500-year celebration of resistance against the government, as they call it. It wasn't a celebration of the conquest, but they were marking that anniversary and revealing at the same time their own gathering momentum as a political group. And unlike the earlier confederations and movements, it was now an indigenous group. They called themselves indigenous people, and they organized as indigenous people. Now, the second part of your question was on, was it the religious?
No, I asked if you could explain a bit more about the development plan, the Plan Pueblo Panama.
Plan Pueblo Panama. Thank you. I'm glad that you brought that up. We have been discussing that throughout the week, and including yesterday's forum. The Plan Pueblo Panama has all the buzzwords that we hear in NGO circles, and yet they have not urged the follow-through on the agreement that was made by government officials in 1996 when the Zapatistas were still a more formidable, let's say, military force than now. The Plan Pueblo Panama was ignored all of the requests for participation in change, even while saying that they were responding to pueblos. It was not a response to pueblos, as the indigenous people have pointed out. There is no mechanism for them to get together as groups in regions and discuss what they want. Now, what they want is a continuation of semi-subsistence, cultivation, artisan production. They also want to do what some of them are doing, and that is organize cooperatives that are run by indigenous people. What they don't want is the essential part, though, of Plan Pueblo Panama. It is building highways, hydroelectric dams, often taken over lands through those procedures that are now occupied by indigenous people. And the Plan Pueblo is also even considering bringing maquilas into the jungle areas as they have in Guatemala across the border. And these maquilas are foreign firms. In some cases, Korean firms are there. They have no respect for Mayan traditions. In fact, they even hit workers in their own frustration as people who don't speak the languages. They don't work with the talents and resources that are there in the field. They impose an alien form of assembly production on a people and literally work them to death. 12-hour days in some cases I've heard of in Mexico. That is the plan, a high investment strategy from outside with no participation. Mm-hmm.
Let me again introduce our guest for this part of Focus 580, June Nash. She is Distinguished Professor Emerita of Anthropology at City University of New York Graduate Center and is well known as a scholar of social movements in Latin America. She's written quite a bit on the competing forces of globalization and the cultural traditions of indigenous Maya, living in Mexico and Guatemala. After many years of studying indigenous communities in Mexico and Guatemala, she is considered a leading authority on Mayan activists and leaders in Chiapas in southern Mexico, one of the most indigenous states in Mexico and also one of the poorest. She'll be speaking on some of this in a talk in the MillerCom series tonight at 7:30 on the U of I campus. This takes place at the Levis Center on West Illinois and is sponsored by a number of campus units, including the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies. These talks are always free and open to the public, so if you would like to hear more from her and you are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you should feel welcome. Also here on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Perhaps there are people who will remember when they first heard about the Zapatistas. It was early in 1994. And I think that a lot of people, unlike you who had spent time in this region and knew about what was going on, I think a lot of people, it seemed that the Zapatistas came out of nowhere. And we were all asking this question, well, who are these people? What is this place? What are the issues here we're talking about? And that we slowly learned about this organization that had come out to champion the rights of indigenous people in this part of Mexico, and at least learned a little bit about it. Now here we're 11 years after the Zapatistas first appeared. Has there been any sort of long-term impact in Chiapas as a result of the Zapatistas?
Yes, it's changed the way people think about Indians and the way Indians think about themselves, and it is a remarkable transformation. It was early in 1994. In fact, the very first celebrations were going on for New Year's when they appeared out of the dark, apparently. They came up from the jungle. They came over from highland indigenous villages like San Andres, La Ranza. They came 2,000 strong. They had been trained, been in training for 10 years, and they had their own leadership. They also had su comandante Marcos, who was serving as their spokesperson on that evening, but many of the indigenous leaders also spoke. Their voices often got drowned in the media, it has been coming through more strongly lately. Now, that evening was a precursor to what has come since. They were handing out leaflets during the uprising. This is unusual for guerrilla fighters. They made the point that their arms were symbolic in many ways, that nobody listens to you unless you've got this. It was on New Year's Eve, and so maybe they had an easier time of it, but they entered into the barracks of Nueva Rancho. They also entered into the penitentiary and let out some of the prisoners, many of whom were political leaders among indigenous and mestizo people. They also entered four of the mayoral offices. But to show you their intent and purpose, a very famous historian of the Chiapas area, Andres Aubrey, who has a research institute, arrived on that night because he had heard something was up in town and saw them burning some of the papers from the alcaldía. And he said, stop, you've got to save that. That's going to be your future. You can base your new governments on what we learn about what happened in the past. And they did stop, and they put two guards on to watch that that the archives were not going to be burned that night. It's that kind of attention to detail, I think, that you get in the indigenous movement that shows quite a different approach to a guerrilla movement that relies in its own way on force, in opposing force. The eleven years since. Yes, you did mention that, David. And in that period of time, They have developed their own leadership. There isn't the attention paid because Subcomandante Marco still lives in their midst, but he is busy writing a detective novel now. It has, of course, a lot of details that are pertinent to the political scene, but it is the indigenous leaders who have taken over the principal voice, and these are men and women. For the first time, Maya women are as active in public life in the Caracoles as are the men, and that has been another extraordinary point in this guerrilla movement, that it was also dedicated to gaining rights for women. I think the revolution of 1910 to 17 in Mexico did reinforce the hegemonic control of men within families, a point that's not often made, and their attention to redressing that deprivation of rights has been a feature that is acted out in the homes and villages. As far as the issue of how they're playing this out in a development process, they are extremely limited in what they can do by their own inability to control the rich resources that are in Chiapas. These are the hydroelectric power bases. It's the oil that underlies most of the territory in the Lacandon that has been recently discovered there and makes it a resource base that they would like to get control from not only central Mexico, but they've been selling off some of the rights to it to foreign powers.
We have some other people to bring in again to the conversation. Let's do that. In Champaign, next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First of all, my compliments to Dr. Nash and to the Center for Latin American Caribbean Studies, because I think this is an incredibly important topic to be bringing forward to the community. One of the things I would like to ask is if Dr. Nash could speak about, given that the Zapatistas began their revolution on the day that the NAFTA Accords took effect, and that was intentional, we just passed the 11-year mark of NAFTA. Could she talk about what the history of what NAFTA has produced for the Maya people, what the U.S. role in all that was, and bring it forward to today, when now we're being asked in the U.S. to support the Central American Free Trade Association. This is happening right now in Washington. The topic's being brought up. This is like the grandfather of NAFTA. So if we're interested in the U.S. and in Illinois about this topic, what can we learn and what should we be doing?
Excellent question. I think that a large part of the reason for the Army not only entering in to quell a rebellion, but staying there for all these 11 years indicates something more than just defusing a rebellion. The presence of the Army began with the insurrection. There were about 13,000 troops during Salinas's presidency the last year. That was augmented when President Zedillo came in, sent in an invasion force of some estimated, all told, it was 60,000, including those who were there. Imagine that, 60,000 with at best, an armed force of 2,000. That is overkill, and certainly represented a formidable force for the Zapatistas and for their supporters, because there are many Christian communities who would object to raising arms in any setting, but who support the objectives of the Zapatistas. They've been living within villages that are now somewhat split because just the sheer desperation of people has caused them to respond to different inducements on both sides, and the internal fissioning process has begun. But the reason it's important, as you suggest, for us to pay attention to this is that NAFTA was a plan, a North American Free Trade Agreement, to open up markets. And why should that bother indigenous people in this kind of corn cultivation that was the backbone of their economy? It was important because North America, and primarily the U.S., Canada was another participant in the agreement, wanted to sell their crops, but they were subsidized crops, as corn, for example. So they were selling subsidized crops at a lower price than it could be produced by small crop cultivators. Now, although much of the corn had gone to subsistence, and they did have cattle and other means of making a living, the Zapatistas and their supporters were not able to compete with this and gradually were losing their lands to big cattle owners right within the jungle area. So it was a threat. And other crops, the same case is true, that they were losers in that trade rearrangement that came with NAFTA. Today we're faced with the expansion of a free trade zone, which includes Central America as well. And while the Plan Pueblo Panama talks glowingly about increasing the exchanges among neighbors within the five countries of Central America, they don't point out that that those exchanges are dominated by external trade relations with big powers. And it doesn't contribute towards a freer flow of goods within so much as towards the outside. Through the Plan Pueblo Panama and through the expanded version of the trade nexus in the ALCA, we have the danger of peasants yet again supporting the building of an infrastructure of highways and hydroelectric dams that are prejudicial to their own interests. I've seen indigenous people out on the roads working to build a highway that they don't even get to walk on because they get down in the ditches next to the roadway that they've paved themselves. And those roads are to take things out, not to bring things in.
And so if there are people here in this listenership who are concerned about this issue, one action that could be taken would be to express concern about CAFTA to their legislators.
I think that we have to be in active communication with our Congress people, indicate that we don't feel that this is improving the lives of peasants, that on the contrary, these trade agreements that are made at a distance from the people who are most affected are reversing the flow of capital. Capital is coming from peasants or the extremely exploitive labor conditions that they work under to increase capital in the dominant countries, not the reverse, so that the trade acts have in effect intensified an exploitative dependency relationship today.
Thank you very much. And the last question I'll ask and then I'll hang up is to ask, that would suggest that we take action in support of justice. What literally can we learn as thinking people from the Maya communities that we could, in fact, help in our own world?
I think that the indigenous people whom I know and those whom I've read about have a much more global way of thinking and are much more willing to embrace plural cultures than we are, much as some of our university centers are trying to, and we have succeeded in some small ways. But their basic way of thinking is a global embracing of difference and of being aware of how important to maintain their own distinctive ways of doing things, because that adds to the richness and complexity of life, not to the reverse. It doesn't necessarily lead to conflict, as many of the leaders within their own countries. This is especially true in Guatemala, where there's a denial of difference as being the cause of conflict rather than seeing it as a source of rich exchange. So I think we can learn from them in that respect. I think we can also learn, as Samuel Ruiz, the Bishop of Chiapas, has often reminded us, of the spiritual values that they express in their relation with the environment, their attempt to think of the future of their children and grandchildren more than we, or at least our leaders, especially at this point in history, are thinking about those precious resources.
One more caller here in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah. I was wondering if you didn't mention the military government which the U.S. Put into Guatemala in 1954, and which after many, many years of oppression of the what some people call the Amerindians, the Highland Amerindians in Guatemala, but basically we're talking about Maya, killed as many as 200,000 people. And to put everything in perspective here, you know, if anybody's done something to damage the Mayan culture, it certainly was the U.S. I'm just curious, are they aware of that? Do they have, do they understand that that military government in Guatemala, which killed so many of them, was backed by the U.S. and, you know, was our idea, so to speak?
I think that during this past week in our conference, this was discussed a lot. There is certainly an awareness, and not just leaders, that the U.S. had a great deal to do. But many of them also see the implication of their own leaders who took advantage of a situation that was opened up to them. Through the various mechanisms, the U.S. has fed the Guatemalan military in particular. They stopped aid in the peak of the genocidal attacks in the 80s, but they have just resumed it. I believe there was apparently small dispensation of about $21 million for the army, and I think that's been approved. These are the kinds of things. I mean, it took a lot of public action in the United States to try and stop that military aid back in the 80s, and it may require that in the future. But following the coup, the U.S. wasn't acting directly. They were acting through Castillo Armas, who had been selected by them and others within Guatemala to carry out the actual invasion of the fields and killing of those who had taken lands in the land reform. There was an interim where U.S. action with some Peace Corps, and I trained Peace Corps people back in the 60s and saw very beneficial results from their work, that was then crossed out by a kind of military aid that went directly to the leaders of the military rather than to leaders within communities. And that was the same period when Rios Montt and others mounted a campaign against the Mayan people. And it took us a long time to figure that out. We are in danger now of, again, allowing that kind of military force to take precedence over peaceful missions. But I think the U.S. has the capacity to do both, and we might direct our efforts towards promoting the latter.
I think that we are about at the point where we will have to stop because we have used our time for this part of Focus 580. However, for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, June Nash, Distinguished Professor Emerita of Anthropology at City University of New York, she will be giving a talk talking about some of this work that she has done observing the Maya, studying social movements in Latin America. This is part of the MillerCom series, among the sponsors, the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies at the U of I. Her talk will be this evening at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center. That's on the third floor. It's on West Illinois Street in Urbana. These programs are always free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me here.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Just a quick mention of tomorrow on this program. In the 10 o'clock hour, David Sinnoh will be stopping by. He's clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois, and for quite a while now, on a regular basis, once a month, always on a Friday, stops by to answer questions about money management, investing, and personal finance. That will be the first hour of the show. Hour number two, our guest will be Jeffrey Stone. He's Harry Calvin Jr., Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. We'll be visiting here at the campus, so we'll have him with us here in the studio, and we'll talk about some of the issues that he raises in his recent book, which is titled Perilous Times for Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. That will be tomorrow in the second hour of the show. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, of course, we hope that you will stay tuned, because coming up next, we'll have news, weather, sports, other things, and another interview, all part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today at noon, we'll have a report of news from National Public Radio, the BBC, and AM 580. Scott Althoff joins us at 12:35 this afternoon with the weather forecast. In the 1 o'clock hour of the program today on the Afternoon Magazine, our guest will be Susan Marks. She is the author of Finding Betty Crocker, The Secret Life of America's First Lady of Food. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Board of Trade and on the Merck. May wheat is trading at 309 1/4, down 1 1/4. July, 318 3/4, down 1 3/4. May corn, 208, up 2 1/4. July, 216 1/2, up 2 1/4. September, 223 1/2, up 2 1/4. And December corn, up 2 1/4.